This is a republic if you can keep it. An inside look at Michigan and national politics with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer.
I'm Mark Brewer. Welcome to the RIP, Rest in Peace, Michigan Republican Party edition of A Republic If You Can Keep It. Just when we thought Michigan Republicans couldn't edge further into the chasm of conspiracy theory craziness, the once grand old party bypasses Trump and pillow guy endorsed Matt DiPerno for party chair because he isn't extreme enough. Jeff will offer what I suspect will be an R-rated analysis of the current status of his former party under the dubious leadership of the tinfoil hat brigade.
I'm Jeff Timmer. Meanwhile, the new Democratic majority in Michigan's legislature is moving pedal to the metal speed on issues near and dear to the hearts of their core constituencies. And I should add, a fairly wide majority of Michigan voters. One of them, tax cuts, will be joined by the Senate sponsor of the legislation providing nearly $1 billion in tax cuts for working families and retirees, Senator Kristen McDonald Rivett.
Well, we have to start with last weekend's state Republican convention. One of Michigan's leading boosters of conservative politics, Detroit News editorial editor Nolan Finley, summed it up accurately. One of the few things I agree with Nolan Finley on. In his column headlined RIP Michigan GOP. And I noticed that you, Jeff, had a few comments on Twitter as well. I know you've been waiting a few days to vent on this podcast in the wake of that convention. So I'm not going to get in your way. Have at it, my friend.
Wow. I mean, I say this a lot. Holy shit. That's really my reaction. It's no secret to anybody who's listened to me once, let alone for the last 2 years on this podcast, that I don't hold out a lot of high hope in regard for the character of the collective Republican Party in Michigan or across the country. I've said there's no depth that they will sink to that will surprise me, except this one actually did. I had thought Matt DiPerno was going to win handily. I thought he was the sufficient mixture of pugnacious for the sake of being pugnacious, angry for the sake of being angry, crazy for the sake of being crazy, dumb for the sake of being dumb, corrupt for the sake of being corrupt, to win, especially. And then when Donald Trump and Carrie Lake and Mike Lindell and the whole Star Wars cantina of Republican circus freaks get behind Matt DiPerno, I just figured it was going to be, a slam dunk. Basically, what it came down to is I thought the sociopath would win and beat the psychopath. I was wrong. And it wasn't particularly close. Karamo ends up with about 60% of the support of the Republican convention delegates. I mean, this is a candidate that Donald Trump, Carrie Lake, Mike Lindell, and all these freaks thought was, man, she's too crazy to win. We can't vote for her. But the convention delegate said, no. The genie is out of the bottle. The monster's taken on its own life. Whatever you want, whatever kind of analogy you want to put to this, it really shows how far the pendulum has swung, the needle has moved, whatever you want to say. The Republican Party is now crazier than the stuff that Trump is putting on his Truth Social every day. I mean, and that's some gibbering, barking madness. But Kristina Karamo I'm not being facetious when I call her a psychopath. And there's not very much connection with lucid reality in Kristina Karamo and the slate of candidates that were elected to be the vice chairs of the Republican Party. And apparently at least 60% of the Republican convention delegates elected an honest to God. QAnon thinks that demons enter the world through premarital sex, tinfoil hat wearing kook. It would be laughable or sad if she wasn't in a position of serious political power. And, I'm curious how much political power she's going to actually have because she inherits a broken, bankrupt, morally and financially bankrupt political party. And she has no ability and no hope to raise any money. But that won't, I guess, probably take away much of her microphone. She still has the email list and she will be getting a lot of attention. But I think in some ways, this is the best thing that could have happened to the pro-democracy forces. And I've said, there is no hope of redemption for the Republican Party in Michigan. Burn it to the ground. Let something else stable and sane on the center right take its place. And the election of Christina Karamo and the kooks and mooks and freaks that came along with her are going to hasten that and galvanize through their idiocy and lunacy and buffoonery and thuggery the majority of Michigan voters who in the last election clearly said, you guys are too weird and crazy and extreme and mean and angry and weird for us. And so the Republicans' answer for that is, oh, yeah, hold our beer. You ain't seen nothing yet. You see nothing yet. Because I don't think people it's going to be a weird 2 years. So with that, I'd like to get your thoughts on, you know, as a longtime opponent, this, what do you think of this?
Well, as always, Jeff, you're a very hard act to follow, but let me see what I can do. First, I want to remind our listeners, you know, Jeff and I aren't making stuff up. Christina Karamo has called Beyonce and yoga satanic. Start there. She said women's march protesters were addicted to pornography. She has called abortion child sacrifice, and she's one of the really extreme views on that issue. She lost the election last year by 14%, and she's the only Republican statewide candidate who has yet to concede. Even Matt DiPerno and Tudor Dixon conceded. And before the election, she filed yet another frivolous lawsuit, which was quickly dismissed by a judge, and sanctions are pending against her and her attorneys for that lawsuit. And that's just a partial list that I just wanted to recite for the benefit of our listeners so that they remember all of this. And it's no surprise that she lost by 14% given all of that. Yeah, Jeff, it is just remarkable. You know, it's just sad to see. I tweeted about contrasting Christina Karamo with somebody I'm sure most of our listeners won't remember, is Ellie Peterson, who is a revered figure in the Republican Party of Michigan. She was the first female chair of the Republican Party. She was chair in the mid-60s. Just an incredible figure, a national figure in terms of her impact and so forth. Incredible organizer, terrific leader. We've gone from Ellie Peterson to Christina Karamo. And I just get goosebumps even reciting those facts. Even though I'm on the opposite side of the aisle from Ellie Peterson, enormous respect for her and what she did, and for, frankly, many of her successors in the party. And it's just a shame to see the Michigan Republican Party come to this pass. I noticed that the first email, fundraising email that Karamo sent out was not for the Michigan Republican Party. It was for her own leadership pack. So, you know, she's taking a page out of the stuff that Trump and all these other grifters have been doing, you know, raising money to benefit her personally. And like you said, Jeff, she's just the leader of the pack. Her co-chair helped support the insurrectionists on January 6th, helped send buses to D.C., and it didn't get a lot of publicity last weekend. But if you look at the list of the congressional district chairs and the other people who are now leaders of the Republican Party, they're cut from the same cloth. The convention didn't make an exception when it elected Christina Karamo. Up and down the ticket, they put people into Republican Party leadership down to the local level, just like Karamo. I'm out of words. I'm speechless to try to describe the state of the Republican Party. You know, some hopeful person I saw said, well, they have nowhere to go but up. I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure that this couldn't actually get worse when it comes to 2024.
Let me throw something out for any intrepid reporters who might be listening to this show or alerted to it. When Saul Anuzis was chair and I directed the Republican Party, we were, I think, at the forefront of, I think, what became a national, a fairly common thing for other parties to do. This would have been, you know, 15, 18 years ago. We took all of the assets of the Michigan Republican Party, all the tangible assets, the building, the, you know, the real estate, the lists, the fundraising lists, the voter lists that are so valuable, they're the only tangible assets. And we put them into a trust that wasn't owned by the Republican Party with outside trustees for fear of someday something like this happening? And I think that's an interesting question, too. Is that structure still in place? I assume it is, unless somebody's dissolved the trust. Christina Caramo might not have any realization or access. She might not realize that she doesn't own these lists. She might not even have access to some of these lists. I think that's something that would be interesting for reporters to find out, who is ready to exercise this trust, this data, maybe prevent the chair. I can say back in whatever year it was, 2012, 2013, when Todd Corser, then before he got elected to the state house, ran against Bobby Shostak, who was seeking his second term, almost beat him in a surprise showing in the convention. There were people talking about, okay, we need to make sure that they can't even enter the building and get access to the computers and all that kind of stuff. He might win, but he's going to win nothing. He's going to get the name and the mailing permit. Those are the.
You've just confirmed something we Democrats have suspected for a long, long time. I remember hearing rumors about this alleged arrangement. So you're telling me that the Republican Party is a tenant in the Sekia Weiser Center there in downtown Lansing?
It was at one point.
It was.
I don't know.
Okay.
This is a long time ago in terms of the – so, and I know other state parties around the country, other Republican state parties have set up similar structures. We were a pioneer in doing this because then we were worried about, you know, what we called the crazies, they seem kind of quaint and non-threatening in comparison to what exists today. But I'd be real curious, and I think reporters should be asking, you know, what do they own?
Right.
What do they have access to?
We don't have such an arrangement in the Democratic Party, Jeff. I'll tell you that. We don't have those kinds of arrangements. You know, we've had our share of people who, you know, have been on the extremes, but we've never, at least to my knowledge, and when I was chair, never felt we had to go to those extremes to try to protect the assets of the party. Wow. That's quite a revelation, my friend.
Next up, Mark and Jeff talk tax cuts with the sponsor of a $500 million tax break for working families on a Republic, if you can keep it.
Epic MRA is pleased to sponsor this podcast. Epic MRA is a Lansing-based market research and public opinion polling firm with nearly four decades of experience measuring public opinion about politics, ballot proposals, and public policy issues.
Our clients include media outlets, school districts, colleges and universities, all levels of state and local government, and membership organizations. For the November 2022 election, Epic MRA published the most accurate final pre-election poll among several state and national polling firms.
Our polls most closely predicted the actual election results in races for governor, secretary of state, and attorney general, as well as the three ballot proposals.
Epic MRA is clearly the go-to polling firm in Michigan. Visit www.epicmra.com to learn more.
Show your support for preserving our republic at the A Republic If You Can Keep It merch store. We've got t-shirts and coffee mugs made to order for lovers of our representative democracy. Just go to our website, arepublicpodcast.com, and click on the merch store button. You aren't fully dressed until you have Ben Franklin on your chest. It's the perfect gift for that democracy lover in your life.
Joining the conversation this week is Senator Kristen McDonald-Rivett. Just days into her first term in the Michigan Senate, Senator McDonald-Rivett is spearheading the expansion of the state's match of the federal earned income tax credit from 6% to 30%. This historic legislation will provide $500 million to Michigan's local economies annually. She brings to the Senate 30 years as an educational and economic policy strategist and executive, where she worked to revitalize neighborhoods, increase youth development programs, and address institutional inequities.
Prior to her election to the state Senate, she served as vice president of Michigan Future, Inc., chief strategy officer for the Michigan Health Improvement Alliance, a Bay City commissioner, and as president and CEO of Greater Midland, Inc. She was also a lead architect of Michigan's birth to five systems of care, Great Start, and its parent organization, the Early Childhood Investment Corporation. McDonald Rivet has a bachelor's degree from Michigan State University and a master's degree in education and public administration from the University of Michigan at Flint. She and her husband, Joseph, are proud parents of six children and live in Bay City. Glad you're with us. I know it's been a whirlwind first couple of months for you all in the Senate and the legislature generally, but tell us what your focus has been. What have your priorities been in these first several weeks as a senator?
Well, it has absolutely been a whirlwind. This is my first time serving in the legislature, my first time serving in partisan office, actually. So, my first order of business was to do the proverbial find the bathrooms, figure out where my desk was, those sorts of things. The beautiful thing about having the trifecta where we've got a majority in the House and the Senate and with the governors, we're able to move very quickly. It's been very busy because we've moved a supplemental. My very first bill was introduced and moved out of the Senate on my third week in office. So there's a lot going on. With a slim majority there, we need to very quickly develop relationships to be able to talk to one another, be able to build bridges across the aisle. So my focus initially was on the working families tax credit. So I've spent a lot of my life actually working in that space. I spent the last 2 years helping build a coalition around it and was thrilled that I got to introduce it as Senate Bill 3. Looks like there's a chance we might be able to get that plus other tax relief to the governor shortly.
On that tax credit, tell us, our listeners, about the scope, the impact of that. How many families, how much, frankly, income, what's the credit worth? How big an impact is that going to have in Michigan?
I think it's going to be it's going to be a big one. And I don't think I know. So the beautiful thing, the Working Families Tax Credit is the Earned Income Tax Credit, rebranded, as to have people really understand what it does. But it's been around for a very long time, almost as long as I've been around. I'm 52. It was really introduced in the 70s. But It's really important because it's based on work. So if you don't work, you don't get it. But what it does is support folks that are earning at the very bottom of the income scale, and allows a pretty big rebate with this increase in the Michigan increase coupled with the federal credit. That can mean over $3,000 at tax time, which is game changing for families. I thought it was an important and was my first priority because we know in Michigan, 57% of our jobs pay less than $47,000 a year, right? When you're looking at the vast majority of us are making less than it takes to raise a family of three in the middle class, we know that we have some structural problems in our economy. And then you pile the pandemic on top of that, we've got a lot of families really struggling. So in Michigan, 700,000 households will qualify for this tax credit, and 1 million children, which is half the state's kids. We have too many kids right now that are struggling to get their basic needs met. And this is a really good way for us to deliver relief quickly.
As I recall, this was supported by Ronald Reagan back in the 80s. And I think when it was enacted in Michigan back in the early 2000s, I think there was bipartisan support for it. So this is something not only huge impact, but enjoys bipartisan support, not in Michigan, not only in Michigan, but around the country.
It absolutely does. In fact, for most of its history, it was the go-to poverty solution for Republicans. That was true for many decades. It's been supported across the aisle. It turned more into a Democratic talking point. When it was cut under Governor Snyder, at the same time that we saw the implementation of the retirement tax, there was it was a very different budgetary time. But when we started looking at it and proposing a large increase in the state EITC, it was really when we were seeing a general fund surplus, when we received a lot of dollars from the federal government, and thought, what can we do that can be fully scaled, that can be transformational for families in Michigan, and help us think about how we pivot our economy? And all roads lead right back to the EITC. So that's why the suggestion was not to go small, to go really big with it. To be perfectly honest, my original suggestion was to take it not to 30%, but to take it to 60%. But we were able to get the 30%. Unfortunately, it's just kind of got caught up in a lot of other political pieces as it got rolled into the omnibus bill. But I'm still hopeful that it gets to the governor's desk, and really hopeful that we can make it retroactive so people can get the checks this year.
Right. And that money, you know, it's going to turn around and get spent. I don't know many people that hang on to their refunds or their tax credits. It gets spent immediately. It have a big impact on the economy.
But remembering the families that this goes to, right? These are folks that live on the economic razor's edge. They used, and we saw this with the relief checks that came through the federal government during COVID. The dollars went to things like diapers and gas and rent and housing payments, those sorts of things. A lot of folks in that income space have not fully recovered. This is the fastest way, no additional administrative dollars necessary, because we just tag on to the federal credit, and it's the fastest and most documented way to actually get checks to folks and encourage work at the same time.
And this has been part of a bigger package of, you know, various tax relief coming out of, and this is like contrary to my whole DNA. I mean, I spent 30 years in how many countless hundreds of campaigns talking about how don't elect Democrats, they're going to raise taxes. Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh my God. And the first thing the Democrats do when they get majority after 40 years in the wilderness is cut taxes. I mean, I don't even know how to process this.
Almost $1 billion. When you couple the working families tax credit with the repeal of the pension tax and the retirement tax, that's almost $1 billion. I think the difference is not whether or not we want to cut taxes. The difference is how we do it. It really was important to me during my campaign, but it's also critically important to the caucus and to the governor that we are getting money into the pockets of people who need it right now and doing it in a way that seems fair. Right. So a lot of the other cuts that were more generalized, the income tax suggestion from last year as an example, has much bigger benefit for those on the wealthier end of the spectrum. And we know that we have too many families in Michigan that can't pay for basics right now. So we need to address that immediately.
I'm waiting for Republican heads to just start exploding, you know, to start talking about how tax cuts are now socialist.
Right.
That'll fit into today's talking points.
Right. It's an interesting thing. My campaign was highly targeted. It was the campaign where they called us seat 19, the one that was going to be able to determine control of the Senate. I talked over and over again about freedom. I talked about economic freedom and the freedom to control your own body and have medical privacy and the freedom to marry who you wanted to. And at one point I just stopped and looked at my husband and said, why am I the Democrat, the candidate that's using the word freedom over and over and over again? But I think a lot of things have changed over the last 8 years.
If I can, just a little personal note there. On election night, I was with the Senate Democratic Caucus, and I get goosebumps as I'm reciting this story, Senator. When we learned that you won, the excitement, the shouting, the thrills in the room that we knew we got to at least 19 was remarkable. Then we had to wait for Senator Hertel.
And that was a long wait.
Yeah, that was a little bit later in the morning. But yeah, I get goosebumps just reciting that story now, because you're right. You were the 19th in a critical race.
We have the video of sort of me getting off the phone and announcing to the room full of our supporters that my opponent had just conceded. We knew at that point that meant control of the Senate. And I've been around politics and campaigns most of my adult life. This was a truly spectacular moment. It was a good feeling. And we do revisit the video from time to time.
Well, good for you. And I know there's a lot else on your agenda, too. Sadly, but I think we do need to talk about this. I know the gun regulation legislation was already on the agenda in the legislature, and that's now been enhanced, sadly, by the tragedy last week at MSU. You want to talk to us a little bit about that legislation, what it looks like, you know, what you think the timeline might be?
Yep. And I also want to talk about the politics around it, if we can.
Sure.
So the piece of it, I am a graduate of Michigan State. I lived in East Lansing for 20 years. I'm a history major at Michigan State, which means my classes were mostly in Berkey Hall. I have kids who went to Michigan State. It really was a terrifying moment when we all started And then most people that I know got it through Twitter. I found out that it was going on through Twitter. And then we got notifications, of course, through the legislature while it was happening. I'm of the age where I have friends who have kids at Michigan State as well. My first thought was, I can't believe we're doing this again, right? And how close it is. And also on the heels of the Oxford shooting. And also knowing that that was the 67th so far in this calendar year. The extreme nature of what's happening with gun violence in our country is gotten to be so overwhelming that you start to watch people go numb unless one of these things happen close to them. It was one of the things on the campaign trail I heard over and over again from moms who were saying to me, stop with the partisan games, stop with the rhetoric. We need to get something done. So there's a package of bills we introduced on Thursday. It was supposed to have been introduced in April. We just moved them up. We felt like it was a really important statement to make. Well, we watched hundreds, if not thousands, of MSU students gathering on the Capitol lawn telling us, do something. Widely supported concepts. It's red flag laws or extreme risk protection orders. It's background checks. The piece that one of the bills that I have is around safe storage. Responsible gun owners want to see that right, have the responsibility connected to it. These are things that you see in polling support 80, 90%. It's not the panacea. It's not the thing that probably even would have prevented what happened at Michigan State, but it is starting down a road to try to address this problem and take some action.
This is one thing we talked about extensively on the last episode of the podcast, right after the shooting had happened. I am so grateful that you're taking quick action and urge bold action. Don't be deterred by the rhetoric of the other side, especially don't be deterred or try to bring along Republican elected officials, because they're not going to come along on this stuff. They're just not. But a majority of even Republican voters will. I mean, these are 70, 80, 90% issues. It's just a reality that we're living in today. You talked earlier about, you know, trying to build relationships and work across the aisle, something that's virtually impossible in today's dynamics. And I think that there's this desire, especially among the way that the media reports these things, unless there is a Republican that votes for something, it's not bipartisan. This issue was very, very bipartisan, and it's supported by Republicans all across the state, just not those who are in elected office, because they're too goddamn afraid to ever do the right thing for fear of the crazy base.
Although I think we can look to what happened last year, and they should be afraid not to. So my election, seat 19, the one that swing control of the Senate, was very hotly contested. We spent millions of dollars on both sides. People telling me over and over and over again, I couldn't win. I was running against someone with very extreme views on these things, as well as some of the other pieces. I won by 7 points. I won by 7 points over almost 8,000. It wasn't even close. And this is a district that has been sitting in Republican hands for decades. And I believe it was the building the coalition of talking to people. I knocked on doors with Tudor Dixon signs. I just sat with people. We knocked on 75,000 doors. And in doing that, conversation built a coalition of grandparents who want changes in the economy so they can see their grandkids. But this kind of stuff, this place where, as a parent, when you drop your kid off at school, they are hesitant to get out of the car. And you're telling them, I love them, knowing that there's a little chance, small one, but a chance you're not going to see them again. People don't want to tolerate that. And it's at the Republicans' peril that they ignore that and try to make these pretty well-supported bills extreme.
I agree with that completely. And I guess what I'm saying is, don't, in order to get those Republican votes, water down any of the things you're doing in order to bring them across the aisle. Say, this is what the bills are going to be, and dare them to vote against them.
Right.
See if anybody has the courage, the character, the integrity to stand up and do what many of them know are the right things to do. It's so few and far between. And some of the people who I think actually had that kind of courage left the legislature in the last go around. But maybe someone will surprise us. Now, when that person does, they're probably going to lose their next Republican primary. But by God, they'll at least have done the right thing in the meantime.
I've decided to remain hopeful. You know, we were supposed to have hearings on these bills this week. Obviously, the snowstorm has moved those into next week. But these are so universally supported by law enforcement, by schools, by, you know, community members, by students, and it's overwhelming. Now, I will tell you, I'm saying that with hundreds and hundreds of organized phone calls coming into my office saying, don't tread on our Second Amendment rights. And it's okay, because I'm not going to, right? These bills do not in any way infringe Second Amendment rights. They're just ways to start the process to keep our community safer.
And I can't imagine there's anybody, I mean, you mentioned, Senator, the nature of your district. You know, Democrat hasn't held that district in a long time. It's a very much a swing area. Mm-hmm. Between the two parties, you know, and given the tens of thousands of doors you knocked on and the way I know you work the grassroots, my sense is you've got your sense on the pulse of the district. And if you say on a bipartisan basis, my district supports this, by gosh, that's true.
Right.
You know, and those phone callers don't know what they're talking about.
Well, and unfortunately, I think that politics, which have all, you know, there's always been partisan politics, but a lot of the Republican tactics have moved from partisan gamesmanship to out and out intimidation tactics, things that are meant to scare you into a specific vote. I've been around long enough, raised 6 kids. It's very hard to frighten me into doing things. But most of the calls coming into my office are not people who live in my district. And we didn't stop talking to folks when the campaign ended. So we are still in houses and kitchen tables having conversations. We're still in churches talking with folks. And I actually, at the State of the State, my guest this year was the founder and the current president of Parents of Murdered Children in Saginaw. Now, there's a perspective and a voice that's important to listen to, that she's been working. Both of these women have been working for years to get the legislature to act on things that would start to curb gun violence. The community stands with those women.
You know, there's another issue I'd like to touch on if we can. You know, many, many issues before the legislature, there's a huge to-do list. But there's also a bill to add protection for the LGBT community to our civil rights bill. Mm-hmm. And I know in addition to the pressure you're getting on the gun legislation, you've also probably been getting pressure to vote against that legislation. What's the status of that legislation? What's going to happen there?
So I am very proud to be a co-sponsor of the amendment to the Elliott-Larsen Act. I believe very strongly in the protection of civil rights and for people's protection against discrimination. It was one of the very first bills that I added my name to co-sponsor. It is moving. We are, again, it's another one that's been pushed simply because of weather, but we'll take it up pretty quickly. Senator Jerry Moss has been the champion on that, has faced extreme shots against his character and all kinds of awful things that have been said about him for doing that. And he persevered anyway. I think that there are some core things that we just know that are about the values and the things that we stand for. And that's what you saw with the first pieces of legislation that were introduced. But this one has overwhelming support within the caucus. You know, I will talk to and read anything that somebody sends me. So I sat down and had a conversation. I'm a practicing Catholic. I talked with the Catholic Conference, said, let me understand. What is the problem here? What are we worrying about? The reality is that the amendments that are offering that actually won't restrict civil rights for the LGBTQ community are unnecessary and covered in other parts of the act. So I would expect that, you know, you'll see it pass with unanimous vote from the caucus. And I would be overjoyed to see some Republican votes on that in the Senate.
And I think you will. I think that's an issue that has ripened in a way that some Republicans in the last session did support and co-sponsor similar legislation. Some of them are gone. Wayne Schmidt from Traverse City was one who I think was a champion of doing what was right and what was good. And hopefully the remaining Republicans, fewer in number than they've been in 40 years, won't be cowed and deterred by the kind of the extreme radicalized thugs in their base, or in their party headquarters now, that control the microphone of the Republican Party, because they are not just outside of the political mainstream; they're outside of the right and wrong mainstream. And this is just, I've said on Twitter many times, your religious freedoms end where the rights of others begin, and you can't hide behind that cloak of religious freedom to justify your bigotry and your hate any more than Southerners in the 1950s and 60s were right in doing what they did. It's the same kind of logical construct that they're using, many of them, not all of them, to hide behind their bigotry and their hate. I mean, I guess I'll just repeat myself. That's what I see their opposition is in many of these people. And I guess I'm not afraid to call them out.
Well, and this is just an area too that, frankly, the Michigan legislature is playing catch up, right? I mean, the United States Supreme Court a few years ago said Title VII protects the LGBT community. Our own Michigan Supreme Court on a bipartisan basis said that last year. So, the legislature is simply codifying what the two most important courts in the country have already said exists. So, yeah, this is something that really should go forward despite this last-ditch opposition.
It seems a pretty obvious thing, but I do think that there are some senators on the other side of the aisle that have specific religious, somewhat bigoted beliefs on this issue. I also think that you have Republicans who are gaining political power by declaring enemies and taking fear that people have and weaponizing it into hate. And that's how their plan is to garner votes, which is actually the most disappointing piece.
That really boomeranged on one of your Republican colleagues last year when Senator Tice attempted to do that against Senator McMorrow.
Senator McMorrow is an amazing, amazing leader and a friend, and was a big supporter of mine during the campaign. But, she picked on the wrong woman. That email that she sent out raised so much money for the Senate Democratic Caucus. She probably paid for a week of TV and all the targeted races just because of that one email. There are a lot of spaces where we're sacrificing people for political gain, or Republicans, I believe, are sacrificing whole portions of our community for political gain. And in my district, they see it and they reject it. Hopefully, they'll get the memo and stop it, isn't it?
Right. Now, Senator, you've talked about in a couple of contexts now the how divisive and ugly things have gotten, but this has also been kind of personal for you, right? We all know that tracking and that kind of activity goes on during campaigns, but you've been subject still to tracking, I guess it's tracking or worse, even since you've been elected, right?
Yeah. So just for context, during the campaign, they were up on TV before Labor Day with the negative ads. And right about June, I got a political tracker. So for folks listening, if you don't know what a tracker is, it's somebody who follows a candidate around with a camera, trying to capture them saying something stupid that you can then throw up on TV. Both parties have been doing it for decades. My tracker started to show up in June. He would wait for me outside of restaurants when I was having dinner with my family. He would stand near my car when I would walk out of places. And it really started to get to a place that I felt fear. The campaign ended. I was glad the campaign ended. Come to the Capitol. I get sworn in on a Wednesday. On Thursday, he's back.
This is not tracking. This is intimidation.
This is intimidation. But I need to tell you that he is a large man. So I'm 5'2", a small woman. He's a large man. He dresses completely in black. He yells comments at me. Most of the time, you can't even hear what he's saying. And we had got to a place where the sergeants, and this happens to two other senators, the sergeants actually escort me from my office to the session floor every day of session. I think was a little naive that the political tactics were going to stay inside the campaign. It is 45 months until I file for reelection, right? This is about intimidation. This is very specifically intended to frighten me and make my life miserable. Now, the negative mailing pieces, we've already had three of them mailed in my district, negative Facebook ads, all of those things are happening, which I think is ridiculous and a waste of money this early. But the pieces where we're getting an intimidation is something I didn't expect. Took a picture of it, threw it up on Twitter. And honestly, in the moment, the reason I did that was because I just wanted to take a little of my power back. It went a little viral. Got about 2.5 million views.
A little viral.
It went a little viral. And I really had to ratchet it back because it's not my intention to focus energy in a way that becomes dangerous for this individual. He's not doing anything illegal. So they've asked me, do you want to press stalking chart? No, he's not doing that. But we have to start shining a light on this if it's going to get better. We have to act differently, and we have to put some daylight on the tactics that are not going that are just completely unacceptable.
You were right. I mean, this is something that both sides have done forever. But there were kind of unwritten rules of engagement, I'm sure. I mean, Mark, when Mark and I were opponents, you know, there were just kind of the boundaries of just good form that people would stay in. You know, there's a fine line between, you know, legitimate public role, but then there's, okay, you're out for dinner with your family. That's different. That's different than when you're at the Capitol. I mean, I don't think you should be intimidated, and, you know, somebody should use their size or voice or those kinds of things against you in that way. But there's places, you know, kind of the, you know, when I'm at the office, there's kind of things that are acceptable. When I'm off the clock, you know, just because you're a public official doesn't mean that 24/7, 365, the public has access in the right to harass you. You know, we've lost this sense in this is something that Mark and I have talked about a lot on this show over the last couple of years, the transition from political opponents to, you know, honest to God enemies. Yeah. And that mindset that so many people have, where in their mind something like this is justified and right to do, that's just something that's wrong. And I think, I mean, most sane people would look at that and say that's just really weird behavior, and that's the kind of boorish extreme behavior that turns off so many people, a super majority of Michigan voters, as we saw in the last election, you know, that coupled with extreme positions on guns or abortion or anything else. But it's the notion and this attitude. And I mean, I know some of these people on the Republican side who feel like they're on the side of righteousness and this is all justified. And that's just something that's wrong and broken in not just our politics, but our culture.
I agree. I think that the word broken is a really apt one. The piece of it that is frightening is that there's these tactics that are irritating on one side, but then when you look at the rhetoric that you see that has gotten the vitriol that's gotten so accusing people of being aligned with Satan, being able to talk about groomers. My campaign, they called me a drug dealer and actually said I was handing out fentanyl instead of candy on Halloween. Now, it's absurd. And people who know me, I'm basically a mom. laugh at that. But there's a fringe group of people who listen to that and they show up. And so it's not necessarily what a tracker for 4 full years on me does. It's what it sparks in people who have gone down a conspiracy theory rabbit hole, right? This is why I think you're right. Most people would think that's a buffoon. And those are the people that have to know about the things that are happening.
Yeah. Well, thank you for shining the light on this, because this is, I think, the example that you shared and that we're talking about is far too common and isn't brought up. I don't think people were aware that this kind of thing is going on, this kind of, organized systemic attempts at intimidation versus political discourse. And this, there's a fine line, and there are some things that just clearly cross it. You know it when you see it. I guess I'll quote, who was that? Oliver Wendell Holmes or whoever said that way back when. You know it when you see it, when it came to obscenity. So,
well, Senator, I think our time is up. You know, we've kept you longer. Thank you. This was a very thoughtful discussion. Thank you for not only your idealism, but your physical courage as well. I'm sorry that you have to go through all of that, but thank you in so many ways for what you're doing, not only for the people of your district, but for the people of Michigan. We're really lucky to have you as a guest today.
Thank you so much for that. Thank you for this podcast. It's a great opportunity to have regular, good conversation about what's happening in politics, and I really enjoy it. So thanks for having me as a guest.
That's our time for this week. Our thanks to Senator Kristen McDonnell-Rivett for her report on her first weeks in the legislature and updating us on the tax cut battle within the Michigan Senate.
And as a former chair of the Michigan Democratic Party, I'm delighted to hear that the Michigan Democratic Party has entered the podcast universe. It's called Parties on the Peninsula with LeVar Barnes, who's been a guest of ours on this podcast, and it is updated every Sunday. You can find it on major podcast apps, and there's a link to it on our website as well. So good luck to Lavora and the MDP as they venture into podcasting.
If the Republic is still standing, Mark and I will return in a week. Thank you for listening.
A Republic, If You Can Keep It, with Jeff Timmer and Mark Brewer, is a production of Michigan Citizens for a Better Tomorrow.